Well, in the first half, I'm going to open your eyes on fossil fuels. Also, we'll do trending topics. And ex-NFL, second overall draft pick, biggest bust in the NFL, so says he. Ryan Leaf is going to join us.
From Corolla One Studios in Glendale, California, this is the Adam Carolla Show. Adam's guest today, Ryan Leaf and Dan Dunn. With Gina Grad on news and Bald Brian on sound effects. And now, he must have set his clocks back too far because he turned on the news and it feels like the 70s again. Adam Carolla.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get it on. No choice but to get on a mandate to get it on. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for telling a friend about that about you, right, Gina Grad?
That's right.
And Bald Brian. Let's drink some beers and rape. Dan Dunn coming in with libations. Interesting that the opening talked about the 70s again, because I was thinking about
the 70s?
A commercial from the 70s from my youth. It's from 1977, so I was a few years away from getting my driver's license. But so someone had tweeted me a guy who is an expert in energy, and who's a guy's name is Fletcher Prouty, and he served as chief of special operations and joint chiefs of staff under Kennedy and blah blah blah. It's a very fascinating, interesting little piece of information that I'm going to share with you guys momentarily. But first, I'll share with you this Chevron commercial from 1977, which looks very 1970s, and it burned into my psyche as a young person because we were going through the oil embargoes, and we were doing rationing, and we were doing odd even license plates to fill up, and it was a lot of we are out of oil,
right?
We cannot get oil. Remember, a lot of the stuff you hear about, it's not old. I mean, it's not new. It's old. The stuff we've been talking, like, woe is me. But when, and this is kind of the problem, when you're, you know, freaking out people about the climate or COVID or whatever it is, young people get their brains scrambled because they're like, holy shit. So I'm sitting around 1977 going, let's see, I'm due to get my driver's license in 3 or 4 years, but it does not seem like we are going to have fuel enough for me to motor around.
Where are you going to go?
I love cars. I'm such a passionate fan of cars, but the thing that works in cars is going to be gone, and then we don't have electric cars. What we don't really realize is we innovate our way out of these things, but we don't think about it at the time. No. So this is a commercial from Chevron from 1977.
Once upon a time, there was a dinosaur, a brontosaurus, a pterodactyl, and some weird-looking sea creatures and plants. Well, before long, the whole bunch became part of a layer of organic material. Then, with a little heat and pressure, they formed a pool of crude oil, which turned into 6 tanks of gas, 3 long hauls, a couple thousand kilowatts, and 4 cross-country hops. Now, we're plumb out of dinosaurs, pterodactyls, and the like, and it doesn't look like they're coming back. So don't waste them. The next time you jump in your car, remember, some prehistoric creature gave his or her all for that tank of gas. So go easy, and America's energy will go a
So this got further. Burned into me, and I was like, yeah, how many dinosaurs could have perished? I mean, sorry, got a little hoarse. Of course we're going to be out of fuel. The fuel's made from dead dinosaurs, and how many dead dinosaurs could there have possibly been?
I mean, a finite amount.
That would fuel us, young me, into my 50s or 70s, and being able to drive an internal combustion vehicle. And it was always sold. It's called fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. We call them fossil fuels. I'll now share this clip, which Chris got it from 8 minutes down to like three and change. But this guy's explaining what happened. And it was always like, yeah, fossil fuels sounds pretty limited to me. Again, I don't know how many dinosaurs. I mean, they dig up some bones every once in a while, but it's kind of few and far between. So he'll explain.
When they first found petroleum, because they were beginning to make motors and needed on axles of wheels on railroad trains and all that sort of thing. And remember, trains started in the beginning of the 19th century. Then oil went from just a lubricant to a fuel, and it made it valuable. And Rockefeller happened to be the smartest man in the business at the time, but he made most of his money, or much of it, off the transport of the petroleum as well as selling it. But one thing they realized was, putting a price on oil is like putting a price on a pail of water. You know, no initial cost. It's in the ground. And in those days, they were, some of it, almost what you'd call surface mining the oil. They didn't go down deep. So in order to get the price up, they hit on the idea that they would have to make it appear to be scarce. After we take the next few barrels out, we're probably going to have to close as well. You know, that kind of thing. But a very fortuitous event. In 1892, there was a convention in Geneva of scientists to determine what organic substances are. Well, the definition of organic is a substance with hydrogen, oxygen, and carbon. And so it's usually a living substance, a tree and grass and so on, living things, animals. We are hydrogen, oxygen, and carbon. So at this Geneva Convention, Rockefeller took advantage of sending some scientists over who said oil, petroleum, is hydrogen, oxygen, and carbon. Therefore, it must be derived from the spoiling, the rotting of formerly living matter. And playing the game properly, when this scientific convention was over, they defined oil as a residue from formerly living matter. Well, that makes it a fossil fuel. I don't know why they decided to use the word fossil, but it says formerly living matter is fossil. Well, of course, today, and another thing we should know is that there has never been a fossil, a real fossil, found below 16,000 feet. We mine oil, or we drill for oil, at 30,000, 33,000, 28,000 every day of the week. So right there, we rule it out that it isn't fossil fuel. It's called fossil fuel for the minds of the public to feel that it is an asset that is running out, being depleted. We talk about depletion allowance, which is a lot of, you know. And actually, if you know the world's oil supply, you know that it is not going to run out for an awfully long time. It is the second most prevalent liquid on Earth. What bothers me is that in geology books, it's in there. The geologists say it's a fossil fuel. They've been bought, but it started from that strange meeting in 1892, a scientific convention. I have a big, thick scientific encyclopedia put out by the Devon Ostrin Company that's about 15 years old now, but it has the whole story of the conference. It doesn't have the Rockefeller part, but it has the whole story of how they straightened out organic chemicals and how it was all figured, and they've got petroleum right in there. These aren't accidental things, you see. There's a dollar sign behind almost everything.
Yeah.
Smart. I've heard the same thing about diamonds. They're not actually that scarce. It's a perception
of
scarcity.
That's the De Beers family started that.
Yeah.
And allegedly.
I'm picturing that commercial from Chevron with the dinosaur's head is coming out of the fuel tank. And I was like, yeah, it's dinosaurs. We got nothing.
So this is going to sound naive and I guess rhetorical, but why then do we allow that myth to continue? Who is it really helping? Because countries, world powers go to wars over something that is not scarce.
I guess it is a combination of oil companies wanting to have a profit, turn profit, seem it worked on me when I was 13. I was like, oh, my God.
It worked on me until 5 minutes ago.
We're out of this stuff. I think it's, you know, usually you have two sides going at something. You got big oil, and then you got environment,
right?
Environmentalist, and each will try to check the other side. But in this case, I think this narrative works for both.
They're
of them.
They're on the same side.
Right. Big oil wants the money, and the environment goes, we're going to be out of this stuff before you know it, so we need to transition into electric cars.
Big oil wants the money, and environmentalists want to push policy through.
Right. So it's interesting, and it was always... It always bumped me, but that commercial always was seared in my head. I was always just like, God, I mean, how, if just dinosaurs, they do it a little. They go like dinosaurs and organic substances, sea creatures. Right. So they make some little reference to, right. Yeah, maybe there's a couple of weeds thrown in there. But no, that's why it would only work if it was trees and grass and all the stuff he spoke about. It couldn't work if it was dinosaurs. But
there would literally
they went out and made a campaign. Chevron made a whole commercial for it.
Wow. There would literally be an oil rig at the La Brea tar pits if this was true. But no.
I know.
Wow.
Right in that swamp.
Yeah, right.
Interesting. The other thing was I think Lynch brought up we're watching John Popper play Bob Marley.
I watched the whole thing several times. Did you watch it?
Yes, it's so good. But in contrast, we have DJ Khaled opening up his guitar Bob Marley, that the Marley family.
Oh, yes, right.
Gave
him.
Yeah, always makes me laugh. Pulls it out of the box.
Look at his fingers on the
top. Open fingers, open chords.
He's just waving hello on the neck.
Yes.
But he's so confident.
Who picks up a guitar who doesn't know how to play a guitar and starts playing the guitar?
From us and our nightmares. Yeah,
that's right. So it's a nightmare.
Narcissist, a sociopath.
Yeah, and says, film me.
Yeah.
Not.
This is going to be great.
By the way,
we
not,
the best.
Not a tip of the cap to the Marley family.
I was going
to
say, a little insulting.
A little insulting.
Would not have been better to be like, hey, I don't play this thing, but look how beautiful
it is. Yeah, right. I don't want to shit upon his memory.
Somebody also tweeted me, DJ Khaled, once in a while he hits the hardwood.
Oh, yeah.
Shows you some of his moves on the court.
He's as good of a hoopster as he is as a guitar player.
Oh, wow.
Oh, there he is.
DJ got the.
Loses the dribble on the third bounce.
It's like the Keystone Cops.
He's just dancing around, goes around the back.
For any Office fans, he looks like Stan Lee bouncing the basketball.
When you shoot the ball, if you do not, if the trajectory of the ball never gets higher than the rim,
than your head,
you have a very limited chance of it going into something that's taller than it is.
Yeah, that's almost impossible.
Almost impossible. Yeah, that's him balling, which is awesome.
Imagine the instinct. The ball goes out of bounds. You're sitting courtside and you're like, these people want to see me dribble.
That's
they want
what
to
I'm
see
saying.
Me hoop.
I would love, I don't want all of it. I would love a taste of what that's like.
Yeah. Personal momentum, man.
People want to see this. They want to see it because they're going to look at it like a success, even though I'm dog shit at it.
Yeah. It's no, the basketball and the guitar are both the same. I don't know what I'm doing.
Doesn't matter.
But I'm doing it and you film it. I don't know what sex is like with DJ Khaled.
Well, you know, he very publicly says he doesn't go down on women.
Oh, right.
And then the joke is that's the only thing he won't eat.
Yes.
I was going to say.
Yeah.
All right. We got the lottery now. We got $1.9 billion.
No, I forgot to get my ticket.
Dollars and people. Oi, I've got behind a few of these people at the liquor store. I just want in and out. I want to get a six-pack and go watch football. These guys are getting their kids' birthdays worked out. They went 3 scratchers and 3 lottos and 3 Powerballers. It's like, oh, and they're always, they're the
gainfully
people
employed.
Who should be gambling the least. It is, I mean, look, they've done this a million times. They go, look, it disproportionately affects poor people and people of color and all. Because, yes, they are trying to get out of this thing financially that they got themselves into. It's insidious. It really is insidious. It just, and also the message is the worst message you could send, which is you're not going to be able to do anything, but you may get lucky.
Right. You probably won't.
Lift yourself out of this mire you've gotten yourself into, but it's so fucked up. But now everyone is buying tickets and the lines are long and I guess it's the most it's ever been.
But it's funny because it's this self-fulfilling prophecy because it's not like, did you hear how randomly big it's gotten? No, it's gotten that big because more people are rushing to pay for it. So your odds go down. You know, if it was just $1 million, you'd have some decent odds of winning.
Yes.
But we're pumping. I've never done. So just out of curiosity, how do you do it? Like you go there, do you know?
I can answer that question because I don't know if this is going to enrage you or make you happy. I stopped at the gas station right around the corner from here, and I went inside, and I think I was getting a soda or something on the way to work, and I noticed the thing said $1.5 billion. I was like, oh, yeah, is it? Oh, it's tonight. This is on Friday, I think it was. And I was like, I'll take this soda and I'll take one Powerball ticket. And they go, okay, sir, that'll be whatever, $10, whatever it was. And I gave him my credit card. Like, oh, can't buy with the credit card. Oh. It's only cash or debit. Ooh. At that point, I said, "Get rid of the Powerball ticket. I'm good. I just need the soda."
Why?
I don't know.
Anything that's cash only is inherently shady.
Yeah, the idea that you would go into some debt, whether it's dollar or whatever it is, to buy a lottery ticket is somehow illegal.
But you can do it at casinos. You can borrow against your credit line.
That's true, but it's an onerous VIG. The percentage is crippled.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Anyway, Max Apatis got some trending topics. Mm-hmm. Oh, he's coming in. Yeah, I was going to say you can do it from the booth, but why not just do it?
Also, California is not a state, apparently, that you can claim the Powerball anonymously. So if you're from here, be prepared to be hounded and probably kidnapped.
I've talked to Mark Garagos about this. I said, The whole Paul Pelosi thing. We don't have the 911 call. We don't have the cops footage from the chess cam. I said, but Demi Moore ODs and her assistant calls in 911 and we get to hear that later that evening. And it's like, yeah. And I said, why?
He goes, it's different
everywhere. They can claim anything they want. And that's it. Now, it always smells of something when it's, you know, high-end politician, but it's like there are no rules. The rules are they're supposed to do it.
Right.
But if they don't want to do it, good luck making them do it.
Well, he would sound especially heroic because they said he did it secretly. He dialed secretly. He got the guy to start talking. Like, that would be a heroic phone call to hear.
It's also, if you'd like to squash the conspiracy theories, stop holding stuff back. It just gets more people to have more conspiracy theories. Yeah, the story is pretty bizarre. He answered the door. The cops were there. Pelosi answered the door. And then he went back in and then got whacked with the hammer.
Well, yeah, and that the police, by the time the police had gotten there, they both had the hammer, and then the guy hit him with it in front of the cops.
I see that this is the whole thing. First off, he was in his underwear. No, he wasn't in his underwear. They both were holding the thing. A third person answered the door.
I had heard that there was like a panic room situation where the cops showed up mid-assault.
Well, from what I read, he slyly, as he was dealing with this guy, called 911. So it wasn't like, 911, someone's here. It's like, and what are you doing in my house, Paul Pelosi? You know, like trying to get them to understand there was a problem. So they dispatched cops. And from what?
But they showed up in the middle of
tug of war over a hammer or something?
Well, that's what they said. But the new thing is, now there's all the more stuff. He answered the door. He let the cops in. Then he walked back in. And then the hammer struggle.
Huh.
That and the NBC affiliate in San Francisco that reported this scrubbed it. They took it off their They took it down off their website, yep, and they buried it.
That was actually NBC National. That was on Good Morning America or something like that.
The people
that was
who
Miguel
reported,
Amadeiris.
Yeah, yes. He answered the door, guy. Then they took it down.
Huh.
This is very bizarre.
Yeah. Yeah, well, if you don't want people to have crazy conspiracy theories, then stop feeding it.
And after Jussie Smollett, now I'm like, this is what they said. I don't know.
Yep. All right. Sorry, Chris. Trending topics.
Oh, yeah.
No one would watch a jackal. That's a lot of. He screams and makes you have to jump to search the internet and make him right. That's the better. His real name's Laxamana.
Thank you. Thank you. Adam. Good news. You might be going to the Oscars next year.
Oh, yeah.
Because they have picked a host.
I saw this.
A white heterosexual male.
What the hell?
Jimmy Kimmel.
Yeah.
Heard of him.
He has been confirmed to be hosting next
Fantastic.
Year.
No home cooking here. Jimmy is a really good host. Like, people are like, oh, this host sucked, or this host, or whatever. Jimmy is a really good host.
Not only that, but...
It's all the jokes.
You have to put a lot of effort into this shit. People do not realize the difference between, a Jimmy Kimmel and the late, great Norm MacDonald. Mm. The work ethic is very different, very different. And if you want to do a show like this, it starts 3 months in advance and you hit it and you work it. And it's really the taxing part of this is the preparation. And I've been on the other end of it, you're getting emails at all hours of the night. We need some stuff for Billy Bob Thornton, blah, blah, blah. It just goes and goes and goes. And if you don't have that work ethic like Jimmy has, I mean, it doesn't matter how funny you are. If you do not have that ethic, it's going to be tough sledding. And he's got the funny and he's got the crazy work ethic. And he has the experience. Like, that's why he is who he is. And I think maybe it's a sign that we're getting back to sort of, look, it wasn't broken territory. Right. We got funny guys. Yes. They hosted the Oscars. People laughed. They go out with a monologue. We liked it that way. Yeah. This is like Thanksgiving is once a year. Give me the fucking turkey.
Give me Billy Crystal.
Yes. Do not do your shit, your own take on
don't
rice
peel off. Don't put cottage cheese in the macaroni.
Just
it's almost time for that.
Once
again.
A year. Just do it. Sorry, Chris.
Ironically, he presided over the one out of his control Oscars that had the snafu with the best picture.
Right.
But other than that, those are exceptionally well-run, smooth ceremonies.
Yeah, we thought that would be the craziest thing to happen at the Oscars in 50 years.
I know.
Hold my beer.
Yeah. Thanks, Will Smith. But that's exciting. So that'll be a Sunday, March 12th. So clear case.
Right. So you think you might be down to do that again?
Yeah. I wrote a lot for the first two, I guess, that Jimmy did and went down there. And it was it's a treat. I mean, it's an experience.
Sure.
It's interesting getting a little peek behind the curtain of the run-through the day before and sitting out in the audience and the cutout. All right. It's going to be 2023. If they don't get a motherfucking colored printer, I will burn that Kodak Theater to the ground. It is black.
It's the Kodak Theater.
It's called Kodak.
It's Kodak. It's in the
it's
name.
Like a Polaroid,
right.
Or the
it's black and white.
Microfiche theater.
It's black and white pictures of celebrities. Most are pretty recognizable. On occasion, you cannot tell because we do not have a color. And when you're on stage looking down, what it's supposed to do is go, this is that's where Michelle Obama's over there and Oprah's over there and George Clooney's over here. These are black and white pictures.
No.
I still want to do my move where I get the Harvey Weinstein cutout head and I just sit it like right next to Oprah's head just for the run through. You know what I mean? Just to see how long it takes.
Any reaction?
Yeah. Yeah.
Some hollow.
That'd be awesome, right?
Yeah.
Gwyneth Paltrow.
Perfect.
I'll just, you know, they don't frisk you. I can go in there. I'll just
piece
unfold
of paper.
It.
You're a writer. Got a prop.
Just put it right there.
It's perfect.
We'll see how long it lasts.
Hey, speaking of movies, a little behind the curtain here. And if you, sometime this week, we're going to do a Bollywood on the Weird Al Yankovic movie.
I can't wait.
It's so much fun.
One of the best trailers I've seen.
It's so much fun.
Yeah. All right. So also a big thing that's been going on Twitter is the whole Elon thing, the takeover. It's been wild.
In the news?
Yeah, he's in the news. Everyone's been talking about him. So we talked about Dane Cook last week where he was like, oh, they're going to charge $20 to keep your blue check mark. But then Elon announced it's going to be $8 a month. It was supposed to happen like this week, but they wanted to wait till after midterms. Now I'm in a room with three blue check marks here.
Right. Two.
Oh, what?
Brian, do you?
Oh, yeah. How dare you?
Yeah, no, all three of you have them.
I remember recently you saying you didn't have
New York Times bestseller. Yeah.
But, like, yeah, how do you guys feel about this?
I said before, the whole point of it was to verify that somebody isn't, like, pretending to be you. So, I mean, if we don't need that and he wants to do it another way, who fucking cares?
Is it $8 a month?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm more curious. I was talking to Dr. Drew about this earlier. The people have very strong feelings about things like this. I'm like, we pay for everything. Right. $8 is neither here nor there to most people, especially the people that are worried about things like Twitter versus, you know, coal miners from turn of the century. So it's his business and he can do whatever he wants. It's sort of, I don't have super strong feelings about it. I'm curious when people do have very strong feelings about much of this stuff.
Right.
It's a bizarre way to go through life because you have very strong feelings about Elon and Twitter, and then at some point you'll be sucked in some other thing where you have very strong opinions about it. I mean, I have very strong opinions about nonsense, but when people's business or how, you know, I don't have very strong feelings about Burger King. It's just like you either go or you don't go. They can do what they do. I have strong feelings about the dessert offerings from either Taco Bell or Pizza Hut.
Mm-hmm. That's all bit, man. Strong feelings about shit that doesn't matter.
Yeah, but this is his business. He can do whatever he wants.
That's exactly what Mark Cuban said. He tweeted Elon, hey, why don't we use some sort of AI to kind of weed out, you know, your bots, but also weed out who's been accurate this whole time, and then they deserve to be.
Don't look at my movie reviews.
And then, with the AI, if everyone's tweeting accurate stuff, they can keep their check mark. And Elon just responded, $8 for everybody. Where then Mark responded, hey, it's your business, your call.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, when those children were stuck in that cave in Thailand, didn't he say the guy that didn't think his plan was going to work was a child molester?
Yeah. Yes.
So pedophile. That might not be. Yeah. So that difference. Might not be in his wheelhouse.
Yeah. Well, because Elon, he calls himself a free speech absolutist, mm-hmm. and he's really working on trying to once again weed out the bots and keep Twitter more accurate. And almost became a meme over the weekend where everyone would change their name to Elon Musk and then tweet as if they were Elon Musk. It would kind of look like it in your timeline. They change their picture and change their account to look like Elon Musk and go like, oh, I'm Elon Musk. I have a really small wiener, blah, blah, blah. And then Kathy Griffin, Sarah Silverman did it. Valerie Bertinelli did it. And it was like a meme. Everybody was doing it to where their accounts became suspended. And then, they were suspended. So Kathy Griffin famously got her account suspended over the weekend. And everyone's all up in arms about that from both sides, obviously, like let Kathy back on, free Kathy versus Elon said the only person she was trying to impersonate was a comedian.
he didn't like it, so she's out.
That's weird times.
I thought it was free speech.
Yeah.
No, I have two thoughts. He can do whatever he wants. He is about free speech, but if you're impersonating somebody, then you have the right to cancel that person, right? And impersonating people.
Then that goes back to exactly what Gina was saying. Like you're going to – if everybody gets a paper check mark, then everyone's going to be impersonating people anyway. And then Musk said
– listen, I like impersonating because it's plausible deniability, man.
Yeah. Wasn't me.
Well, and that's the funny thing too. That's how you know you hit the sweet spot because when that was tweeted, I just wrote – free speech, question mark? Just, you know, like maybe this is part of the conversation. 19 fucking incels came for me. And then this morning when I said, you know what? People hate change. And when we finally get most of that change, we don't know how we ever lived without it. So I'm actually curious and kind of excited to see what's going to happen. And then somebody tweeted me, asking me how long it takes me to suck Elon Musk's dick every morning. So I know I'm right down the middle where I'm supposed to be.
Well, and, a lot of people, like Sarah Silverman changed her account back because she didn't want to get her suspended. But Whoopi Goldberg, she just said, I'm leaving Twitter. She's trending right now on The View today.
Oh, I didn't notice.
Yeah, well, we have a video of it. We'll play it for you. Oh, she announced her
decision. She's
on Twitter.
So it has been a little over a week since Elon Musk took over Twitter. And the place is it's a mess. He's already called back some of the workforce he fired a few days ago. He's putting his $8 charge for blue check verification on hold. First, it was going to be $20. Now it's going to be $8. He also suspended Kathy Griffin for impersonating him on a parody account, which has started a free Kathy hashtag to trend. I'm getting off. Getting off today because I just feel like, you know, it's so messy. Yeah. And I'm tired of now having had certain kinds of attitudes blocked and now they're back on. Yeah. And I'm going to get out. And if it settles down and I feel more comfortable, maybe I'll come back. But
didn't they start this? Didn't they start it by showing her Twitter handle? It said at Whoopi Goldberg.
Well, you got to verify that she even tweeted a goodbye on Twitter. But this is really, I don't know if maybe election season brings us out in people, but I'm getting out of here. I'm moving away. Mm-hmm. I'm like, it's just everyone's making proclamations.
Can they get one chick in that mix who's like, what? What are you talking about? First off, she's on the show where she has to speak and she has difficulty expressing ideas using words, which is a weird deficit to have when you do a show for that.
Somebody's doing all right.
Yeah.
That's true.
It's so fucking weird. I don't know. I look, all I have to say is, I don't know, Whoopi Goldberg is 65 years old or something. I had no idea adults would be this way.
No
idea. When I was a kid, I thought everyone was wearing a cardigan sweater and, you know, stroking their beard.
In
if
the
you're
library,
a guy,
the smoking room.
The women would have short hair and you know, say things like, Jesus and gee willikers
and brisket
and good gravy and
tacos to ready.
Casserole dishes and recipes would be exchanged. I didn't know everyone would just turn into a flaming nut job. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah.
These are adults. We didn't have this. When I was a kid, adults were goddamn adults. I mean, my shop teachers were adults and they would never do any of this stuff. It's bizarre.
I said golly in all sincerity today.
Did you?
I did. I walked out to take tests at school like, golly, it's cold. I said, golly.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's what I meant.
Like the Progressive insurance commercial. Is that the Progressive one where you're becoming your parents?
Yes. Yeah, the lecturer with the mustache is teaching you how to. Those are great spots.
They're great spots, but the message is we would like these people to kind of get back to being adults.
Don't shame them.
Yes.
All right, let's bring it home because Ryan Leaf is waiting in the waiting room.
Check out the Water Cooler podcast, please.
It's time to check Adam's voicemail.
Ace Man, I'm at work right now, and guess what I get to do? I get to watch The Hammer. I get paid to watch your greatness. God damn it, you're fucking awesome. Love you. Get it on.
You can leave us a message at 888-634-1744.
Thank you, genius. I appreciate that. Ryan Leaf is joining us. Bust the Ryan Leaf story. I think he told me himself that he considers himself the biggest bust in the NFL draft. He went number two overall to the Chargers after Peyton Manning. Does that title bother you, or do you embrace it?
Well, I named it my podcast, so clearly I embrace it now. But no, it infected me for a while. But then I realized the people calling me that were guys that never played the game, media. You know, my brothers, the guys I played with, like my peers would never say something like that. So I think for the longest time it did, but you know what? I kind of pandered through the process, right? I heard the story about Brian Bosworth back in the day when everybody said he sucks. So he sold these t-shirts that said Bos sucks and made thousands and thousands of dollars doing it. So that's what it turned out for the podcast when over, you know, a bunch of people download it.
Yeah.
There's a way to make some money doing it, I guess.
God, I was thinking about this as I watched Tom Brady beat my Rams with 7 seconds left in the game on Sunday. Tom Brady, he's 45? What, I mean, yeah. Did he come into the league a year before you were drafted?
So here's a good story about Tom Brady. So my final college football game was in the Rose Bowl against the University of Michigan. And that dude was on that team, and he couldn't even get on the field. I tell this joke all the time that Coach Price and I were watching the other quarterbacks warm up on the other side, and there was this number 10 with the name Brady on the back with these, you know, big shoulder pads and skinny arms coming out. And I looked over to Coach Price and I said, Coach, that's going to be the greatest quarterback to ever play the game. And, you know, it's funny to think that was the case, but yeah, he's still playing. To do what he did yesterday, I don't care. To do what he's done in the last 10 years, in my opinion, I strain my calf trying to warm up to go on a hike every day. I'm 46 years old, so it's not for the meek of heart, that's for sure. The guy's really put a lot of effort in. He's amazing, actually.
Brady was a rookie in 2000.
He was a rookie in 2000. You were drafted in 98. Yep. We spoke. Something jumped into my head. So you got out of the gate pretty good in San Diego, right? I think your first game was pretty solid, and then the wheels start to sort of come off, and I'll get to substance and things like that in a minute, but kind of walk us through it.
Yeah, I mean, I won my first two starts. No one had done that as a rookie since 1983 in John Elway. So, and you know, Peyton on the other side of that coin was in Indianapolis. He had thrown a bunch of interceptions. They had lost the first two games, and I thought, you know, like, I got this, right? This is exactly, I'm winning every aspect of things. And then I went and played at Arrowhead the next week, had been in the hospital all week with a staph infection, tried to go, terrible rainstorm, played the worst football game of my life. And it's not, the wheels didn't come off because I played a bad football game. The wheels came off because of how I dealt with it, right? I there's a viral video, like one of the first viral videos that exists of me yelling at a reporter, you know, how I battled the media over the rest of the season, my teammates, everything like that. How I dealt with the failure was way worse than the failure ever could have been. And it just goes to show you, right? If you are not prepared or not willing to, you know, evolve and take and be accountable for things, you know, it's over in a hurry. It is a flash in the pan at the NFL level, no matter how talented you were. And I was as talented as anybody.
I'm guessing you probably figured it out pretty quick. When you lose it with a member of the media, that thing feeds on itself, or it's like, oh, we can get to this guy. We can get to this guy pretty easily.
Well, I think like anybody who works in the media, you're trying to build content, right? And I became a content machine. That's what I became for them, right? It fueled them. And no matter what I did, right? And I thought I was winning because, you know, I'm an ass. And I think that what I'm doing is right, and that I'm smarter than everybody in the room. And of course, that's never the case, especially from a football player. So it just spiraled and spiraled and spiraled until I just walked myself out of the NFL, right? The thing I wanted to do since I was a little kid. And that's what we, you know, it's what I cover in the podcast. It's rare that you see a podcast or hear somebody tell their story from start to finish. And it's unvarnished, right? It's truthful. It's vulnerable. It's transparent. It's brutal at times. It is, you know, and I think that's the important piece to it. So when somebody listens to it, you know, they don't think he sugarcoated it or he didn't take accountability. I understand what my part was in it. I didn't have any control what anybody else did, but I know what my part was in it, and now I know that. And so I think it was important to talk about it.
Did you see the Matthew Perry interview when he was talking about his addictions and going into open houses and going into the bathroom and opening the medicine cabinets and I looking for, you know, prescription drugs. And I thought, I think Ryan Leaf told me he did that. And I don't know if you, well, we'll play the clip because I just told Chris to grab it.
I guess the weirdest thing I did was on Sundays, I would go to open houses and go to the bathrooms in the open house and see what pills they had in there and steal them. And I think they thought, well, there's no way that Chandler came in and stole from us.
Why is Chandler here to look at my $500,000 house?
Deep eyes. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Did you tell me, did you share that story with me?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, Matthew and I know each other. We were going through some of the similar problems at the same time. My brother knew his sister, and the family really tried to get us together to try to help one another, essentially. And so I've been really, really pleased to kind of see him out there speaking about this. His new book's out, of course. And, you know, I told him that story that I used to do it. I don't know if I gave him the idea. I don't know. But, yeah, that was like my drug dealer was my hometown. I didn't know a drug dealer. So open houses, friends, families, houses, I'd go over, pretend I was there to visit them and, you know, would rummage through their medicine cabinets. I mean, some would realize I took something later on and not do anything and enable my behavior, and others would just never know. Because when I got sober and I went back and made amends to a lot of people, they just were so shocked that I did that. I'm like, why? How are you shocked that I did that? I mean, you witnessed and seen and heard all the stories and seen the things reported. How are you shocked that I didn't come in and manipulate the hell out of you and steal your pills like that? And well, the funny thing is that it had been like 6 years later and they went to the medicine cabinet to look and they're like, you're right. They're gone. Like, what? Right. I mean, they've been in there forever. So it blew my mind that someone who had pills in their house wouldn't be gone. Like they would be sitting there for years. I'm like, what's wrong with you people? Right.
Yeah. I felt that way when I met a friend that had a Hostess ding dong dispenser.
Like a Pez dispenser.
Like you pop the bottom of it off, you stand down. It up and you put it in the pantry and you pull one off and another one slides down. I'm like, why have we not destroyed this box?
And why is it still standing?
Like, well, it's been there for a week or something. I'll have one once in a while. Like, you live in a house where you pull out a ding dong and there's a replacement ding dong and you not all. Because I was thinking like a junkie at that time. What, at its worst, what was it for you? I think Matthew said he was 45, 50 Vicodin a day.
I mean, whatever. I had to get 100 milligrams. So however I got that, you know, if you found 10 pills that were 10 milligrams, you take 10 of them. If you had to find, you know, 20 pills that were 5 milligrams. So, I mean, the bigger issue is the fact that I didn't die from acetaminophen overdose, right? Because, you know, all that stuff is mixed with Tylenol. And I can't imagine the amount of Tylenol I was taking when I had to take the 20 pills to get it. You do what you have to, right? There's nothing, there's no diversion or anything that's going to stop you from the idea of dying, the idea of going to prison, the idea of being caught. I mean, none of it exists. It becomes embarrassing when it does happen, of course, but you're willing to do anything to feed that habit because it's such a psychological drug. It hits those receptors in your brain and you absolutely have zero control over it. And it's incredibly sad. And we see it happen all the time. And we see it happen to people who are just going through surgery and are given pills for the first time. And it becomes a thing that they become addicted to immediately.
Yeah, it is scary that it can take hold of people at later, you know, way later in life, long before you think that window, you know, that window is like for smoking. You know, if they don't get you by the time you're 19, you ain't going to be a smoker. But it's this.
I never took a drug. I mean, I smoked weed in Amsterdam one time because you're in Amsterdam, so you smoke weed, right? And I've never taken another drug in my life except for prescription painkillers. And that happened when I was, 26, 27 years old. So didn't drink alcohol till my 18th birthday. I mean, it was completely reversed. In fact, I thought people that did that stuff were morally corrupt, right? I was on a different path, and I was going to be better than you. And, you know, ironically enough, I ended up being this – you know, this junkie thief So, you know, the joke was on me ultimately.
Did you ended up going to prison for some time, right?
Yep, 3 years.
3 years. What was it for?
Burglary, for doing exactly what Matthew talked about there, you know, breaking into people's homes and stealing from them, and then possession, you know, possession of a controlled substance without a prescription. So, you know, I was, they kind of made an example of me. They gave me 7 years for that. Luckily, I wised up while I was in there because of, you know, my roommate kind of, you know, kind of became my guardian angel of sorts and taught me a new way of life. And I got out in 3 years. And that was December 3rd, 2014. And ever since then, it's been about, you know, making the right choice and making it about other people and not making it about me.
Did it save your life, you think, personally?
Yeah.
You do hear that.
I mean, I don't know if prison saved my life. I mean, I can say that I had to be humbled in that way, and I'm grateful for having spent time there. I mean, I don't recommend it to anybody. Don't fucking do it, people, right? It's not, you know, don't do that.
Well, what I'm saying is you hear about all these street crime and the guy's been arrested 25 mm-hmm. times, and then the politicians are like, these are low-level drug offenses or whatever. You shouldn't have to be in prison. Well, the guy's living on the street and beaked out of his brain and like attacking people after being arrested 25 times. And we're talking about, the woman who's jogging through Central Park, the victim. Maybe for the guy's good,
right. They
should be in prison. I've had a few friends that had some pretty serious substance issues, and the prison actually prevented them from going where they were going. And they were going there.
I would recommend nonviolent drug offenders are in treatment. I wouldn't recommend them being in prison. I didn't know a drug dealer when I went to prison. I know 100 now, right? So it's not a place for a nonviolent drug offender to be. It's not rehabilitative at all. It's just another society, right? It's the reason why we're the most heavily populated prison population in the world, in the United States, because it's just another society.
I should modify that. Taken somewhere and treated.
Yes. Intervened with.
Intervened
with. Yes. The best thing that happened to me was the sheriff's department showing up that night and saving my life. Yes. So I'm so grateful for that, because I couldn't do it on my own. You're exactly right. We as addicts and those who are dealing with a undiagnosed mental illness, there has to be an intervention. And I certainly needed that to be intervened with.
I've heard from people I know in the past who've struggled with addiction that they say that to be an addict is to only feel better than everyone else and totally superior, or like a complete piece of shit and inferior to everybody else. Would you say that, is that something you identify with? Is that part of what sets people off?
Yeah, egomaniac with a self-esteem problem.
There it is.
A great definition.
Right.
It is a great definition of it. That's exact. I thought my shit didn't stink, and then I looked in the mirror and go, you piece of shit. Mm. You know, that's the way I rode with it. And then eventually at the end of my career, you know, people were telling me I was that piece of shit too. And so I started believing it. There wasn't too many moments where I still felt good about myself. But I can give you a story while I was in prison. That roommate of mine, he convinced me to go down to the prison library and help prisoners who didn't know how to read learn how to read. That was going to be like my first act of being of service to another human being. And but I still remember, you know, walking down the prison hallway like a child, thinking, this is stupid, this isn't going to help me, doesn't he know how important I am? And like the irony of the guy in a red jumpsuit in a prison hallway still thinking he's important, I think, is the most asinine thing you can imagine. And so luckily for me, I didn't follow how I was thinking about myself at the time. I followed him and started doing that type of service, and it's just it benefited me to no end, because it really gave me the life that I get now.
Did the NFL, you know, now it's a lot of emphasis on protocols, you know, concussion and emotional things. I mean, the NFL is all up in all the big causes they're down with and stuff. You're this is going on 24 years ago with you. Do you think today's NFL would have intervened with you and said, you got not for drugs, but for emotional issues? Like you've got to get some counseling, or the team, or was there those efforts?
Well, I'm sure there were efforts to try to get me to see something differently, a sports psychologist of sorts. But also, it wasn't something that they wanted public either, right? Because the stigma that exists. I don't believe for a moment that the NFL believes any of the stuff that they're doing either. I believe they're going where the wind blows or where the PR campaigns tell them to go. They are a propaganda machine. They are a money printing propaganda machine. That's what they do. They understand that. And so they want, and they, I would just rather them be honest. Hey, we know who we are. We exemplify a violent game that ultimately ruins people's lives down the line, but we want to give you the best product we can possible. I would respect them so much more if they said it blatantly that honest than to try to cover it up with all this bullshit around the side of it. Like, they don't care about the players. They don't care about certainly the former players, as so many of them are dying because of these head trauma that they've dealt with. And so I just have kind of said, hey, it's up to us now, the NFL Brotherhood, all of us, the 27,000 of us in the last 100 years, it's our responsibility to be there for one another, because they're not going to, regardless of what you think you might see in the commercials or whatever else they present.
How big, you know, you're such a standout in college, number two draft overall, you know, in the running for the Heisman. Did you guys win that Rose Bowl, by the way?
You know, we lost on a final controversial play. In fact, a rule change came from it.
Tuck rule.
There was a two seconds left, and I went to spike the ball and clearly spiked it before the clock ran out. But the clock went to zero. We were at the 26 yard line going in. We would have had one final play, and the rule changed because of it. Now you aren't allowed to spike the football unless you have 3 seconds left on the clock. So there's a bunch of controversy around the final play of the game. Ultimately, we got beat 21-16 to Michigan and you know, Charles Woodson, who won the Heisman Trophy that year. And it's a great football game. It's always given our head coach and a lot of Coug fans out there an excuse to say, we didn't lose, we just ran out of time.
You go back and watch some of those films on occasion?
You know, I haven't. I've never watched the Rose Bowl because I think I would be just too upset in how it finished. Because I know I should have done something differently too. I shouldn't have not even tried to spike it. I should have just ran a play, because then no matter what, we would have had a chance. Instead, by spiking the ball, you know, I was ultimately saying, hey, well, I want to stop the clock. I want to get a new play in and run it. That's what the hope was. But if I just call a play and we run it, we get the playoff, and I would have had a chance to at least throw for a touchdown possibly and win the football game, but I didn't. So, and I would have, you know, I would have been upset with the way the referees dealt with the in the situation. So I've never watched it again.
You know,
pretty much like I've never watched any of my NFL games. There's no need for me to go back and look at highlights. I live.
It's an interesting phenomenon, which is whenever I talk to athletes, even at high level, or just guys who played like high school football and stuff, it was seared into the brain is when they fucked up. Like, it's seared. Yeah. They remember that play or multiple plays. Like you never forget. And you're, I don't know what the process is. That I've done it with a few things where I've screwed up, and it's like I keep thinking about it. There's so much glory. There's so many touchdowns. You scored and all that. But yet, if I said to you, you know, just give me your first thought that comes in your head, you're talking about football, you'd probably get back to not being able to spike the ball in the Rose Bowl while the clock ticked down, although you've scored, you know, hundreds of touchdowns. It's interesting, and maybe it's good. I mean, maybe it helps us.
I think it's a big reason why those of us who have been successful, it's because it fuels us, right? I mean, we think about the losses more than the wins, and that fuels us. I mean, there was a reason why I got up on my own at 6 a.m. when I was a high school kid to go into the high school gymnasium to shoot free throws and three-pointers. Like, I mean, normal people don't do that, right? I remember I missed a big game winner, a three-pointer, in a big game for us, and it just fueled me. I was up every morning. My dad would drive me to school. I'd be there before anybody. I wouldn't go to homeroom until I'd hit enough three-pointers or enough free throws. That was what I did. And guess what? later that year, a big opportunity happened, and the next time it came along, I buried it, and we won in a big crosstown rival matchup, and it was because of the work I put in. And that's, I think that's a lot of times what fuels us athletes who are elite.
And also, it feels a lot like an Applebee's commercial, too.
Do tell.
I'm just kind of picturing it, and the dad putting his arm around you in the pickup truck, missed the one, and you went to Applebee's when you lost, and then you alarm close up of the alarm going off, and the dad standing by the pickup.
Bag of Applebee's. We're still an Applebee's commercial, right?
No, I guess it's the one
probably where it would have probably been some local cuisine back in Great Falls, Montana. So I'm thinking Howard's Pizza or Taco Treat would probably be the one that you're thinking
it's
of.
It's a
there.
Local
so
spot.
What was it? What was it like being the like literally big man on campus in a small school or district that way? Like, I mean, you're big. Dude, and certainly big for a quarterback, your dimensions are what?
Yeah, almost 6'7", 250 pounds.
That's
so, yeah.
A big-ass quarterback.
You know, in high school, well, I'm the only Montanan ever to be drafted in the first round of the NFL draft. So there's more first-round draft picks in the Manning family than the whole state of Montana ever. Okay, so there was no trailblazer. So I had to figure it out on my own. I wanted to get out of that small town. And so I burnt a bunch of bridges, right? I competed my ass off. I was not the popular kid. My hometown and my home state did not like the way I went about things. Like, my heroes were Jalen Rose and the Fab Five at Michigan. I wanted baggy shorts, shaved head, black socks. That's how I did it on the basketball court. You know, when I dunked the basketball, I turned into a jumbo jet and flew down the court. No one liked it.
That's not going to work with the Applebee's Corporation, by the way. I'm just
not. Not the conservative, you know, people of Montana. So I just pretty much in my mind thought, you know, I got to get out of here. So I wasn't the popular kid in high school. You know, I didn't go to parties. If I did, I showed up with a six pack of 7-Up because I thought I was better than everybody else. You know, those types of scenarios. When I got to college, that was a different deal. Like, when in a small town, Pullman, Washington is a small town. I think 21,000 people in the entire town, 17,000 of which go to the college, right? So if the college wasn't there, the town wouldn't exist, and you are the star quarterback, and you're taking a team to the Rose Bowl that hadn't been there in 67 years, yeah. Back in the day, no cameras except for the wind-up disposable ones. I'd be walking on campus, and you got freaking people there while I'm walking to class, guys I'm peers with, just flipping the camera and taking pictures and stuff like that. It was a weird experience. It fed into that ego. That pedestal got higher and higher, and I thought my shit didn't stink. But it was an interesting affair being in a small town like that, being a college football star. I enjoyed it probably way too much more than because when I was in high school, it was such a negative thing for me then. And this was ultimately such a positive one.
Has your story been optioned?
It hasn't. I haven't sold it. I've had a bunch of opportunities.
It would be very compelling, and we'd all be very.
I felt like I'm writing a book. Yeah. I'm writing a book, so maybe that will be the first step to all this. I found out by doing the podcast, I don't need anybody else to tell it.
Mm. True.
So many people have tried to tell it through their own lens, through their own words, not mine, and it's my story. And so when Kevin Connolly came to me and we talked about how we wanted to do something kind of out of the ordinary with Bust, that's what we did. We sat in a room like this with two microphones, him on one end, me on the other, and I told my story. And so no one needs to tell it for me. Sure. I have it ready. So if you're a screenwriter, here's a transcript. You already got it written for you. You know, you can embellish what you want with it, fine. I'm okay with that, but I mean, you have it written. Here it is.
Yeah.
The podcast is called Bust with Ryan Leaf, or the Ryan Leaf Story, and it's out, and it's wherever you listen to finer podcasts or any podcasts at all. Ryan, always great speaking to you, and let's not wait so long in between visits next time.
Yeah, it's been like 5 years, I think, man.
I know.
I love coming to your little place right there. We live right before. We just moved to Connecticut, so we lived pretty close to you. We were out there near kind of towards Glendale, if I recall correctly. You still there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Come on by. Ryan Leaf, everyone. Thanks, Ryan.
You bet, fellas. Thanks, everybody.